Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Back to breaking down the Nancy Guthrie investigation. We're going to take it from a different angle this morning. ABC News reporting Friday that sources inside the investigation believe the case may soon be transitioning to a smaller, longer-term task force. The first official signal that 400 investigators working 24/7 for 3 weeks isn't sustainable without results. The family has been briefed, apparently, that leads are not necessarily panning out and the DNA is still unidentified. No additional video has been recovered. No vehicle has been associated with the abduction. Lots of questions, not a lot of answers. And of course, I'm sure that reporting is going to be contradicted if it isn't already by somebody, because that's how this works. One person says something, the next person says, nope. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, former chief of the counterintelligence behavioral analysis program, is here with us to help break down where we're going here. Robin, let's talk about this. I mean, realistically, we are talking a week, 4 weeks in now, almost a full month into this investigation with 400 full-time investigators. And then you got a smaller task force working alongside. And the family has been briefed, apparently. You know, certain leads, they're not panning out. In your experience, you know, running investigations, running FBI programs under sustained pressure, what does this look like? What does this transition moment look like? Are we in a transition moment? I guess maybe we should start there, as we're a month in and still not a whole lot has materialized.
Yeah, it's actually pretty standard what's going on. And interesting words, you know, not much has materialized that we know of, but there's a lot always going on behind the scenes. I'll take it kind of my impressions about what I would be feeling, because anything else is conjecture, because we're not getting the inside scoop from the lead investigator on this one. But I always liked it when things started getting to this point during my investigations, during our operations, because the noise is stopping. And what I mean by that is, so you have an initial surge of people and resources coming in because you have such a massive volume and you really don't know quite which direction to go in. I mean, you're going to have the typical profile based on reps and past experiences that you're going to typically focus on. But you have, as we've seen, sometimes tens of thousands of leads that come in, and you need a lot of resources to run those down. Plus, you have the digital forensic side, the standard forensic side, and then you have the interviews that have to be done. There's an immense volume of things that have to be done. And every single one of these 400 people that come in, this is a collateral duty. This is an add-on to their otherwise really important work every day as well, their own case backlog of things that are important. So being able to get, you know, for that 400 that came in, being able to go back to their primary job is really important for all these other critical investigations, as well as for the lead investigators themselves, because they're trying to not only manage the investigation, but manage all the people, you know. And then a lot of times these people are brought in for a public show sometimes that they want to show the public, you know, hey, that this is so important. We're bringing all these resources in. Meanwhile, you have a lot of people potentially at this point starting to twiddle their thumbs every day wondering what they're going to be doing. It's like during 9/11, I used to sit on the Intrepid aircraft carrier, which is a museum, because our building got shut down and we reported at 6 a.m. in the morning. I sat on the floor of the aircraft carrier with my squad and you waited for someone to come by and hand you a lead, a paper lead that said, go do this. Mm-hmm. One did that. You came back, you sat on the floor and you waited again until the surge ended. And our surge lasted from 9/11, probably just past through Christmas when we actually started going back to our day jobs again. This one, obviously, it's a bit different, but it allows the lead investigators to kind of keep focusing in on that center core of what they need to be doing and processing. So this is standard. This is normal. I'm not seeing anything unusual in this. And they say that some leads are panning out. Of course they're not panning out. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the way these things work. So I'm not seeing anything really unusual in this. You're seeing the public side of the mouthpieces that spout things that are, like you say, sometimes they this way, flip flop, wind blows, whatever. But I'm still pretty solid on what we're seeing lead investigators doing, because I still am very confident there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes. Doesn't mean it's necessarily going to be solved fast or quick or it will ever be solved at all. We're hopeful of that. But I still think there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes and they're able to narrow their focus.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, is there a way or is there a reality here where sometimes there's just the simplicity of there's too many cooks in the kitchen. There's mm-hmm. too many people that are involved in one thing. And then that, you know, as well-intentioned as it may be, ends up working against the greater, you know, goal here of figuring out what happened to Nancy Guthrie.
Yeah, but at this point, I don't think so. I think they're pretty solid, you know, because there's always, I've seen this in numerous cases and it's so many things over so long that you always have, you know, the public affairs side of things. And very rarely, if ever, do you ever hear from the lead investigator themselves. They're the ones that are just keeping the blind eye, not watching the media, not watching social things, not running an investigation based on public opinion. They're really zeroed in and focused on the things, the data that's coming in that is important. And then you have the public face of things, which are people like the sheriff and all that is the other noise that's going on that are trying to give little glimpses of what they know or what they're guessing at maybe sometimes of what the investigation actually is. So there's actually two sides of this. The one on the ground is the one that we don't know as much about. And I like that we're not getting a lot of different leakage because mm-hmm. we're still seeing some momentum. In my opinion, it's not vast, but I think it's relentless at this point still. I'm still hopeful just because there's still more to do. I don't think everything's flushed out yet.
What do you make of what we have seen publicly? Two people have been publicly detained and released in the investigation. I'm not going to say their names. They don't need right. it. But right. And they're both like, yeah, we had nothing to, and they don't have anything to do with it. Both turned out to have no connection to the case. When you have, you know, people like, people get into being detained publicly, and if it turns out to be absolutely nothing. I guess walk me through a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes here, where they're getting leads in over here. Then it's eventually, you know, getting to an agent. And then, as we've seen in some of these cases, you have people detained temporarily and then released. How do they determine what weight to put on these things? Because you got everybody and their brother, I'm sure, calling, and some certainly have really valid leads. Others have voices that came to them through their tinfoil hat that are telling them what's going on. And not all of it you're going to know if it came through the tinfoil hat or it's something viable, depending on how they're explaining their information to you. So how are they prioritizing and understanding, okay, this is one we really need to go detain somebody, or this is one where, you know, we just need to go, you know, chat it up with somebody at a coffee shop or drive by a location or something?
It goes through multiple filters is mm-hmm. what, I mean, it's the easiest way to kind of think about it, you know, my visual representation. So every lead comes in at this base level, through a tip line, through investigation, we'll just call it through the base level of like a tip line coming in. And what happens is it filters through that first level of, is it plausible? Is it real? Is it you know, all these different kind of wickets, you know, to kind of flush out to the next level of, all right, we need to take a little bit deeper dive on this. And if it falls into the realm of a possibility, then they start looking at all these other investigative things they're doing. Does it overlap in any way? So in other words, if someone calls in a tip, hey, I think my friend is acting weird and he looks a little different and he came back and he's got a full backpack. He left with an empty one, or he left with a full one, came back with empty, whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. What they're now going to do is they're now going to take that tip. They're going to interview the person that sent it in, and if they can get them. And if they can't get them, then they're going to kind of put it on the side to see if any of these other data points flush out to corroborate the information that they're calling in on a tip line. Or if they can interview them, they're going to assess the person that sent it in, if they're credible or not. And so all these different things kind of are happening before it even reaches a lead investigator. So they keep doing all these filters to flush it out as it's making its way towards the top. Now, if it passes all these wickets, so say we have someone, one of these two individuals that were detained and questioned, it passed all these wickets, made it up to the lead investigator. And by the time it reached the lead investigator, they had enough data and information to fill out a probable cause thing that's going to go to the judge to say, hey, we have probable cause for detention, or interview, whatever it is they want to do, so they can flush out that final level to see word of mouth from them, an alibi, what they can say about all the data they have, explain this away, because it reaches that point where like, hey, this is a possible because all these data points that we have are aligning. We need to go talk to this individual, and they go talk to them and they can corroborate their location and all the things. And so all the data kind of falls apart. Doesn't mean that they're necessarily completely off the radar, but it's been pushed aside as lower level noise.
Yeah. Yeah, and there seems to be there's a lot of things going on here. You have obviously what the public is perceiving, which at the end of the day doesn't mean anything. The investigation is the investigation, and we hope to God they're doing a good job. Publicly out here, from everybody watching on the ether, goes, oh, well, this looks rather confusing. And I don't know how confusing it truly is on the inside, or how confused we are, because there's so many voices coming out with so many different things on this. Well, this person is contradicting that person. I mean, is this a case too? Is this a new product of the world that we live in, where it's not only that we have too many cooks in the kitchen going on here, but we have too many reporters reporting? And I'm not in any way trying, and I'm not trying to say anything negative about all of the social people out there. We're getting better information from the social reporters than we are network reporters. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say that. So don't anybody take it as that. But you also, when you have that many voices and you have that many different modalities of communication, each one seemingly to have a little bit different in terms of their journalistic ethics and how they communicate and what they're going to do to get information and what they're willing to say publicly as information comes in. Some, you know, you normally pause on, is this something I should put out there into the ether? Someone's name, someone's identity who's just being questioned right now. Typically, you know, more old school journalism, you're going to take a beat on that. And you're going to wait because you don't want to get sued, number one. And you also don't want to ruin someone's life. But we have this, you know, level of new journalism, if you will, that goes on. Some understand the importance of that. Some do. And some just simply don't care. It's all about getting the clicks. Is more the confusion coming here on this case simply because this is, we haven't seen a case like this in God knows for how long. And we have never seen a case quite like this being run through the filter of the state of media reporting today. It's never existed like this before.
Yeah, all those things are definitely playing in. And I think the clickbait plays a large part of this because, you know, you want to report something new when there's really nothing new to report. So that's where conjecture comes in. I mean, I was looking at one of the news feeds this morning about, you know, I mean, just, so here's a great example. So they're saying that the Pena County Sheriff is now saying there's possibility of other people involved.
Mm-hmm.
That's not new. But now they're twisting that and using it as other people are involved. No, yeah. It's not actually what's said. There's always a possibility someone else is involved until you flush that out. But people are running with something that sounds different because it's different. So they think they got the lead and they got the break. And so it kind of escalates from there. Meanwhile, it's nothing really new. And part of it also comes from, and I saw the comments from our listeners, you know, with the confusion from the sheriff. Yeah, you know, from what we're hearing from social media and some, I think ABC put a lot of this out too. You know, there's some rift between, you know, the sheriff and some internal people going on. And so here's some conjecture about why we could get mixed messaging. So the sheriff is elected to really be the face of the department, and he's put out there. And so he's the one that's the mouthpiece of all things that are going on. But if you have people internally, as has been reported, that are not a big fan of his in some way, and then they're going to not tell him everything that's going on because they don't like him. And so he's might be making some guesses or then making some statements and hearing how he said a wrong statement. Because in other words, the communication between the sheriff and the lead investigator might not be the best. And so that's why there might be conflicting issues too. But that doesn't mean that the investigation is not going the way it should. It means that their mouthpiece is not necessarily doing what he should. So
yeah,
I this is different. And I apologize. We've covered a lot of cases where I haven't been a fan either of the investigators, you know, that there's a lot of things that look shady, looked off, a lot of things. I'm not seeing that here. We're seeing a sheriff that his communication is not the best for what the public's looking for. And so, but again, on the investigative side, you would have more. Think about this. If there was a lot of, because there's a lot of people in the kitchen, like you said, on this investigation, you got 400 people on the ground there. You got a lot of different agencies and organizations. I'm not hearing any internal strife between anyone on the ground there. There's no leakage of that coming out. So that's why I'm thinking, you know, there's good work being done on the ground, because the only problem that people are having is with the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that means that's what might be where the problem is. And so not on the investigative side. Again, I'm always glass half full, so we'll see.
Is this an example of when you know, you have somebody in power, the sheriff Nanos, and prior to all of this even happening, take Nancy Guthrie out of the situation. He already had that like 98% vote of no confidence. He already had a lot of controversy around him for decades. He already had a lot of people that if you're the sheriff and you want to be an effective sheriff, you need those people on your side and you need them to be able to believe in you. And they don't. And they didn't. And they haven't. And they won't. So then something big happens and now there's suddenly all this attention on you. All of those votes prior ahead, those votes of no confidence, those expressions of no confidence, yet he sits there and still yields the power and holds the power and says, trust me, but nobody trusts him. Look, even if you do think you can do the best damn job in the world and your ego is that big and that no one else can possibly do better than you, you still need the other folks working with you and around you to be on your team. And it comes down from the top. Perception is going to be reality in some of these cases. And when you have this and you have especially internal strife, internal people who already don't like you, may not be wanting to work in your best interest or for you to have any sort of gains here, even though this is the type of situation it is. Isn't this just a prime example of when you're in that position, whether or not you're the best damn investigator in the world and you know it, if nobody believes in you, get the hell out of the kitchen. You will not be effective there for the greater good of what we're trying to do. And it's only your ego that's keeping you there. The rest of the cooks have already said, you're not the chef. You don't know what the hell you're doing. You may think you are. You may have the cookbook. You may have done this enough, but you're not good at it. Or nobody believes in you. And unless you have that team there, this is not going to work for you. But it seems it's like a battle of, I'm strong enough. We don't think you are. And everything in between. And it just creates far more chaos. And it ends up being about a person and not the actual goal of what the investigation and the case at hand is here.
Yeah, it's definitely distracting, and he's the sump of all things coming in that are negative here. And, you know, all you can do is try to place yourself in his shoes, again, always thinking that every human being is acting in what they think is their own best interest. And yeah. I'll give benefit of doubt of what he thinks is the best interest of the case and investigation. And the only thing I can, I mean, there's, I'm sure he's got his own reasons. He hasn't explained why he hasn't appointed someone else, or I think one of the reasons why he's saying less is just because of this. But also, for as much, so again, here's a glass half full. He's drawn fire away from investigators. And so that might be helpful because he's being all the, in other words, he's a noise black hole. Everything goes to him. And so it keeps all the noise and distraction from the actual investigators themselves, which maybe they would have been flooded by, you know, having all these news reporters following them around or trying to figure out who they are and just inundating them. And maybe he's becoming that negative central focus point. So that everything gets sucked into him and keeps them allowed to do their job and business. So that's the only thing I kind of think of, that why he wouldn't be doing less or be more consistent.
It speaks to a lack of awareness of one's abilities and the ability and the awareness of one's the perception that one has, or lack of accepting it. I don't know. I mean, you get into dangerous territory there, where even if at the end of the day he's thinking he's doing the best thing, you're not. I mean, I don't necessarily think he's acting in any sort of like nefarious way, trying to like not get this investigation where it needs to be. But if you're just going to hit your head against a brick wall, then call it a day. I mean, it's up to him if he wants to put the FBI on the lead on this, and he's choosing not to, amongst the chaos and amongst basically votes of no confidence of everyone. That's on him. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not just trying to pile on the negativity of the sheriff, but it's like, dude, wake up. I mean, I saw somebody say people bullying the sheriff, and it's not bullying. We're calling a spade a spade. These are documented reactions to this man for decades. This is not like, oh, I don't like him, or the investigation isn't going very far, so let's be critical. This is a track record. This is a history, a pattern of behavior that does not have the greatest track record out there. Not even a good track record. So that it leads to far more questions, and it leads to far less confidence in a case where you need confidence, not only from the public, but certainly your own team.
You know, it's a neat observation. Bullying, as I saw that too. Thanks for popping that up, Todd. You know, bullying the sheriff. And so now here's an interesting take on that. From the sheriff's point of view, he probably feels like he's being bullied. And what happens when we feel like we're being bullied? We get insecure and we want to fight back against it. So you can understand the behavior pattern. Although that, like you said, that objectivity and having a loving critic saying, dude, you need to take a step back because our messaging's way off.
Yeah.
And the public is confused and you're eroding confidence in the investigation because of this inconsistency and incongruence about the messaging that's coming out, which makes a hell of a lot of sense of what you would think they would do. At the same time, you know, as you're sharing that, Tony, the other thing that struck me about this is there are not a lot of examples that from the case that you and I have covered where we could say that messaging was fantastic. These law enforcement guys got this messaging down. They're really good at it.
Yeah. You're right. I mean,
It fits, you know, so let's go back to my behavior arcs. So if we're looking at behavior arcs of public discussions and public notifications and spokespeople and media reps for law enforcement across the board, if he did really, really well, it'd be an outlier from what we expect because it keeps falling short of what everyone always wants and needs. I'd say I remember when I was at the FBI Academy, and I was teaching there, the National Academy comes through there, and these are the top law enforcement professionals from all agencies across the United States and foreign as well, go through the National Academy for a period of time. They get credits towards advanced degrees through University of Virginia and other things. And one of the classes they have is public speaking and public affairs. And so because it is definitely a critical need and a critical responsibility of the top of the organization to be able to speak coherently and publicly on all these critical cases with a lot of people's eyes on you. And this is a major failure in this case and in a lot of others.
Is that kind of like a throwaway class? Is it kind of like, and we're going to do this? because it feels like that is such an important piece to all of this. Maybe not necessarily to the investigation itself and the modality of the investigation, but having the public behind you and having that is critical. It is important. It certainly does affect the psyche. It affects the investigators. It affects morale if you have the larger group that you're working for backing you up, not sitting there criticizing your every move because somebody can't get through five sentences without fucking it up. And that seems to be the problem. It's like it's such an important thing in so many, and I'm speaking broader terms here, not just this, but so many departments, it's like, oh, okay, the person that's going to literally drive the vehicle that's going to explain all this to the public, this huge asset of ours, the public, we're going to put the blind deaf guy on that and expect them to drive the ship and not crash it and be able to hear people. It feels like that's what they put out there so many times. It's like, what are you doing? This is not... Get somebody qualified for this position at the very least.
So, you know what it looks like? First of all, the training that they typically get, it's hard to imagine training that goes through a curriculum development and gets certified to be delivered to law enforcement professionals can keep up with the types of media that's going to be covering you. Because, I mean, just think about this. People like you and me and the hundreds of others, if not thousands of others, not just, you know, cable news, but people like us that have podcasts focusing on this that are going to do deeper dives in different areas and different nooks than the sheriff is even doing himself. And so what happens is that I don't think you can ever be prepared enough these days for these types of questions that people are going to be throwing you at a press conference. And people like us and all the others that are doing these deep dives, these nooks and crannies to ask all these important questions. And so what happens is he's going up there with a prepared statement over to one or two or three nuggets he has, and then he takes questions and thinks he can answer them. And that's where you get the wild-ass guesses, the wags.
Yeah.
It's these wild-ass guesses. He puts those things out there, and then he gets contradicted by his investigative team that says, what are you saying? You never asked us that question before. Here's what the actual answer is. That's why it's wavering like this, because I think he's impromptu answering questions that he wasn't prepared for or didn't do the research on, because you got really, really smart people asking really intelligent questions that he never contemplated before. So, bam.
And then people like that need to have the confidence to say a few words, I don't know.
Yes.
We're looking into it.
See, and there's our own insecurities and his that can't say, I don't know yet. I'll find out for you and get back to you. I mean, and so think about this. I'll keep going back to that, to the head of the state police in Pennsylvania that was in charge of the Cavalcanti escape. Mm-hmm. He did such a good job at his press conferences because he would answer just like that. Here's the things he had prepared. Here's all his background. Here's who's doing whatnot. And when someone asked him a question that came out of left field that he wasn't ready for, he's like, you know what? It's a really good question. I'll get with my people. I'll get back to you tomorrow on that. I'll follow up with you. And they would then put something out on Twitter, on X, whatever, you know, to follow up on that question. So it wasn't like impromptu, but when someone has the confidence to say what they know, but actually the security in themselves and what they're doing to actually say what they don't know and be transparent about it, that's what trust is anchored in. Because remember, open, honest communication, transparency, and vulnerability. That vulnerability thing, saying that here's what I know, here's what I don't know.
You want a leader that's confident enough to say, I don't know. That's not weakness. That's honesty. That's,
And good point that one listener just put up there. He's used to working with local news. Yeah. And when you're working with a friendly local news that is giving you, remember, 6 minutes. He's used to 6 minute sound bites. And so
it's a new world. Great. I mean, the world that they're having to navigate through, and so many, I think, cities and markets and officers and police forces have never had to do it yet, because this world of social media, the world of true crime reporting, is to the level we're at, it changes every year. We're more advanced than we were a year before, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's bigger than local media. It's bigger than network media. It is now the big thing. So it feels like a lot of these institutions, their PR departments, they were prepared for media circa 1995, and they've never really updated themselves in 30 years.
Right.
Buckle up and get better, I guess would be the... the advice. Better. Yeah, just get better. I mean, just get it. Times have changed. It's, you know, it's not just, you know, the newspaper, the radio station. It's all of this. It is what it is. It's not changing. If you'd like to be perceived better, then do better.
You know, it reminds me when I went through undercover certification school, my good friend Jack Schaefer, who wrote the book, The Like Switch and The Truth Detector, is one of the founding members of the behavioral analysis program inside the FBI. And he used to teach this advanced undercover course with me. And when you're being interrogated, say you're an undercover agent overseas and you're stopped and detained by a foreign power, and you only have so much information you can give in your bucket of who you are and your fake identity. And every time one of those things is gone, it's gone. You can never bring it back. But we had this thing called the Fort Knox defense. And the Fort Knox defense, I use it so much. I use it with my kids have used it. And what the Fort Knox defense is, having one standard statement that is, you know, when you're asked a showstopper question that you don't have a response to, you have to have a standard answer that you always go back to that will, one, tire out the interviewer because they're going to get the same response, and it makes it so that you don't give them more to work with than you have to share. And so for me, when I was interviewing someone, say I was trying to recruit a source, a competent human source, or aspire something, if they'd say to me, so Robin, did you follow me here today? Or Robin, how did you know I was here? Or Robin this, I said, you know what? My standard response is, wow, you know, Tony, that's a really important question you just asked, and I want to give it a lot of thought and time and intention. So instead of giving you a quick answer now, let me get back to you tomorrow on that. That's my standard Fort Knox. So anytime you ask me a question I'm not prepared for, that's my response. The sheriff lacks a Fort Knox response. And so that's what skilled interviewees do, is they have a fallback that, hey, here's my standard answer if it falls outside of this pattern. And so That's why he is failing in this area. He does not have it.
Sheriff, we want you to do better. Listen. Take some pointers. Your thoughts on the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue this part of the conversation there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now, and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.